I have argued, in fact, that the media, these media companies in particular, have set themselves out as a part of the machine of genocide that's being perpetrated in Palestine. You have the Israeli forces that are one key pillar of this. You have their Western sponsors in the US and the UK and other Western governments that shield them from accountability. They're another pillar. But what I've said is there's a third pillar, and that's the role of complicit Western media corporations in knowingly disseminating Israeli disinformation and propaganda, and in the process justifying war crimes and crimes against humanity and dehumanizing Palestinians, and blacking out any real information on what's happening in the genocide on the ground. And that's a terrifying thought, because these media companies have reach, they have influence.
So hello and welcome back to Palestine Deep Dive. My name is Ahmed Al-Nauq, and today I have a special guest, Craig Mukhaiber. Craig Mukhaiber is an international human rights lawyer and former senior United Nations official. He left the UN in October of 2023, penning a widely read letter that warned of genocide in Gaza, criticized the international response, and called for a new approach to Palestine and Israel based on equality, human rights, and international law. Craig, it is really good to have you with us today. Thank you very much for joining.
Thank you, Ahmed. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you very much. So let me start by talking about your recent story that you published on MondoWise titled "Western Media Can Be Held Legally Accountable for Its Role in the Gaza Genocide." I read that story and I was impressed, you know, because maybe you know about me, maybe you're not, but during this genocide, I lost 21 members of my family in October last year. And then after that, I lost many family members. And the first, in one of my first interviews, I started attacking the Western media. I accused the Western media of being complicit in the murder of my family and the families of the Palestinian people. I have ever since been very, very critical of the Western media. But that is because I am a journalist and I know what Western media is and what and how they failed the Palestinian people, not only on the 7th of October and after that, but before that. But I was surprised to read a story written by an international lawyer, a UN figure, saying that the Western media can be held accountable for its role in the Gaza genocide. So my question to you is, why did you feel it is necessary to write a piece like that? And as I said, because you are an international lawyer and a human rights activist, you're not a journalist. So what compelled you or challenged you to attack the Western media like this?
Well, first, Ahmed, let me extend my condolences to you, since this is the first time we're meeting face-to-face, on the horrific loss that you have suffered and that so many people that you know and care about have suffered as well. This is a moment in history when there is so much pain and so much loss being experienced by so many people. And in what is, as many have said, the first live streamed genocide in history, where we are all witnessing the horrors that are being perpetrated by a state that has been placed above the law, that has been granted an exception to international law by its Western sponsors, principally the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, and much of Europe. And it's exactly that reason. You're right, I'm not a journalist. I've been an international lawyer for more than three decades. I spent 32 years at the United Nations as a human rights lawyer. And as a lawyer, to witness the degree to which an exception has been carved out for one state, not only to be able to commit crimes with impunity, but to be able to enjoy the support of powerful actors in the West, including and perhaps especially Western corporate media organizations, which have, you know, very shockingly, in my view, carried out a campaign of propaganda that I think is unparalleled in recent history. But it's not unparalleled in all history. And that's why, as a lawyer, what I was identifying in that piece was avenues for actual legal accountability for the role that Western media corporations and the BBC, which I guess is not a corporation, have played during this genocide. And I have argued, in fact, that the media, these media companies in particular, have set themselves out as a part of the machine of genocide that's being perpetrated in Palestine. You have the Israeli forces that are one key pillar of this. You have their Western sponsors in the US and the UK and other Western governments that shield them from accountability. They're another pillar. But what I've said is there's a third pillar, and that's the role of complicit Western media corporations in knowingly disseminating Israeli disinformation and propaganda, and in the process justifying war crimes and crimes against humanity and dehumanizing Palestinians, and blacking out any real information on what's happening in the genocide on the ground. And that's a terrifying thought, because these media companies have reach, they have influence, and their influence includes not just the general public, but it also includes decision makers and policy makers in the West who turn to these media corporations for information and analysis, and who are then responsible for providing direct support, arms and intelligence and diplomatic cover and economic support to the Israeli genocide machine. That's a very direct nexus between what these media companies are doing on the one hand and the harms that are being perpetrated on the ground. And I said in the article as well is that another part of the audience that is being incited, and I do use the word incitement intentionally, includes Israeli dual nationals who are US and Israeli nationals, or UK and Israeli nationals and so on, who are also consuming the information that's coming out of these media companies and then shuttling back and forth to literally participate in the killing. So that's a very direct nexus. And so what I did was I just tried to set out the case, looking first at the precedents that exist. You know, there is this thing called international law that says that this kind of incitement is a violation of international law, and that there's a duty on the part of states to prohibit this kind of information. There are precedents going all the way back to the Nuremberg tribunals with Julius Streicher, publisher of Der Stürmer, who was convicted of incitement by Nuremberg. In fact, he was hung for the crimes that he committed contributing to the genocide of European Jews during the Second World War. And then more recently, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda that held three media figures accountable for their knowing incitement for doing the kinds of things that we have seen some of these media companies doing. And I said they're not exactly the same as these historical precedents, but they've crossed the same legal lines.
Yeah.
So just to finish the thought, I said that if genocide and incitement to genocide and complicity in genocide are international crimes, and they are, every one of those is defined as a crime in the Genocide Convention, as well as other kinds of incitement also prohibited. And if we know that Israel is committing genocide, and that it could not commit that genocide without the complicity of the US and the UK, but especially of the US. And if we know that that support from the US for Israel could not be sustained without media incitement, so that what the media is doing is manufacturing consent, to use Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman's language, for the genocide and making it possible for the government to continue its support of what Israel is doing. And if the media companies know what is happening on the ground, which they unquestionably do know, we all know because we can see it on our screens, and they know what they're doing to support it, and they know what they're doing to obscure the realities of what's happening on the ground. So there's that legal element that they are knowing in what they are doing. It's not just being negligent or unprofessional, but they know what they are doing. And if they are very influential and powerful and are publicly and systematically disseminating propaganda for war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, including disinformation, dehumanization, incitement to violence. And as I said, if there is a direct nexus between what the media is doing on the one hand and actual harms on the ground, which is transmitted through U.S. officials who are providing the weapons and the cover and so on, and dual nationals and so on. Then they are meeting the elements necessary for a conviction for incitement to genocide or incitement to crimes against humanity and other related crimes. So you look at what the international law says, you look at the historic precedent for holding media figures accountable for breaches of that law, and you look at what's happening now and what these companies are doing. And for me, there is a very straight line to accountability. Now, accountability doesn't have to be criminal accountability, but what I'm describing here is supposed to be subject to criminal accountability. But there's also, for example, civil courts, you know, tort law, where you can hold figures accountable for slander, for incitement, for other things in civil war, for the damages that they, civil law, for the damages that they have caused. And then there's also economic boycotts of these companies, protest, demonstrations, and so on to hold them accountable. But one way or another, if they are not held accountable, they will continue to function with this model. And that will mean that anyone who falls on the ideological line for these companies as not being human or on the wrong side of a conflict that they've taken sides in is going to be exposed. And so we all have a duty to make sure there is accountability. One last thought on this, Ahmed. The other point that I made in saying this was that the last thing we want to do is to undercut any guarantees of freedom of expression, because we know that when freedom of expression is limited or eroded, we are the first victims of that. They're not going to go after supporters of Israel or of US policy. They're going to go after the people who are defending the Palestinian people, who are challenging the US and Israel in their crimes. So we don't want to do anything to erode the protections, the free speech protections that are codified in international human rights law and that find themselves in many national laws as well. But some of these things are crimes, and some of these things are also torts, and some of these things are also journalistic and ethical violations. And on those three levels, the perpetrators in these companies need to be held accountable. And so that's really what the article was all about.
Do you think that some of these publications in the West, in the mainstream media, know that they can be held accountable for their coverage on Palestine?
I don't think so. I think there is generally a climate of impunity and exceptionalism. And so, as I said, Israel feels that impunity and that exceptionalism, that it is beyond the law. And I think that these media companies have learned over time that when it comes to reporting on Israel, they have a similar kind of impunity. Mm-hmm. I think they would not have gone to the lengths that they have gone if they thought there was a possibility of accountability. I said in the article, if you watch mainstream Western media during this genocide, you will have no idea that Israel is on trial for genocide in the world court, or that Israel's leaders are the subject of requests for arrest warrants for crimes against humanity in the International Criminal Court. You will not have heard all of the statements of genocidal intent that we've all heard coming from the president, the prime minister, the cabinet ministers, and the military commanders of Israel. You'll probably still believe that on October 7th, that Palestinians beheaded 40 Israeli babies, which is a false story long proven to be fabricated. And you'll also be unaware that Palestinian babies, in fact, have been beheaded by Israel. You won't know about any of these, you know, the torture camps, the systematic rape of detainees, the Israeli snipers that target small children in Gaza, or the fact that Israel holds the world record for the murder of journalists, of aid workers, of UN officials, of healthcare workers. Instead, you will believe this false narrative that has been fed to you. And then when you go to vote, or you go to put pressure or not on elected officials, or you go to consume media, you will not be equipped to take a moral or even a legal course in all of that. So they wouldn't do all of that. They wouldn't issue They wouldn't punish their staff for trying to tell the truth in these media companies, as has happened. They wouldn't issue editorial guidelines that prevent you from saying Palestine or Palestinians or occupied territories or refugee camps, legally accepted terms, as happened with media companies. They wouldn't be dehumanizing the victims every time Palestinians are killed by referring to them as human shields or collateral damage or terrorists. They wouldn't be giving instructions to their editors to speak in the passive voice, so Palestinians are not killed by Israel, they just die somehow. They wouldn't be repeating the false, non-credible stories that are fabricated by Israel as atrocity propaganda without first checking to see whether it made sense or whether it was even possible, let alone true. But because they have a sense of impunity, because they feel that they can report in this way, they are not bound by journalistic ethics or any sense of what the law might say about holding them accountable, and that's perfectly fine for them. Because on the one hand, you know, what we call media are companies, they're corporations, they have owners, and those owners have their own ideologies and their own political objectives and beliefs and their own agendas. And these companies happen to be owned by people whose agenda includes impunity for Israel. And so their companies are reflecting what their ideologies are. These companies are also companies that have close financial and economic relationships with tech companies that have Israeli interest, with weapons manufacturers that benefit from the continuation of these kinds of military assaults and so on. So they are living in the sweet space. Morality and law is not relevant because they have that unchecked power and this exceptionalism. I think it is our job, the job of all people around the world, to begin to hold them accountable by bringing legal action where it is warranted, and where it is not, or is too difficult, or is not possible, protest and demonstrations and exposing what it is that they are doing, and then also using economic influence, you know, unsubscribe from these companies, encourage others to do so, turn your attention and your support to independent media companies that have a conscience that don't create these kinds of exceptions, and hit them where it hurts, which is on their bottom line, because their bottom line has become a blood-soaked bottom line.
Wow. And under the law, are there any limitations for media whatsoever when it comes to reporting on the conflict, do they have the absolute freedom to say whatever they like?
Well, you know, most of them are not thinking about international law when they are publishing. I think they're trying to operate within the space that they believe the country in which their corporations are headquartered are. And so those that that report in Israel, or those that report out of Israel, subject themselves to the Israeli military censor. And they report only what Israel wants them to report. And that includes not just Israeli companies, but it includes companies like CNN, which not only embeds its reporters with the Israeli military and then has direct, it means that their content is directly controlled by the Israeli military, but even their reporting, which is done internationally, they're required to feed their stories through their office in Israel, where it is subject to a kind of censorship as well. And then for those that are, you know, working out of the United States, for example, they're thinking about U.S. law. And the U.S. has traditionally had a relatively expansive vision of free speech codified in the First Amendment of their constitution, and it was very wide. It even protected hate speech. So you could make slurs and malicious stereotypes and racist comments, and that was protected by the First Amendment. Now, the First Amendment, we've seen, has certain limitations. Criticizing Israel has been subjected to punishment in the United States in spite of the First Amendment. You have municipalities and states and even the federal government passing laws penalizing criticisms of Israel, which is in direct violation of international rules on free speech in the Universal Declaration, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, but also of the U.S.'s own constitution. But even before they went completely crazy and began eroding civil rights in the U.S. in the name of an oppressive foreign regime, Israel and its proxies, they did allow for certain exceptions to free speech. But those were things like incitement to imminent lawless action. So speech that incites lawless action that's going to take place very quickly is not protected. And people can be penalized for that. Defamation is not libel and slander is not protected. True threats, real threats to somebody is not protected. So-called fighting words, words that would provoke imminent violence, is not protected. Fraud is not protected. Some obscenity is not protected. Child pornography, false advertising, you know. So there are limitations on speech. Those kinds of limitations, as far as I know, have never been applied to a foreign policy situation, to a foreign situation, what's happening in other countries. And so they feel a bigger a sense of freedom, and not necessarily good freedom, in those cases. In international human rights law, we have the concept of incitement as well. So international human rights law says that you need to prohibit incitement to discrimination, hostility, or violence. You want to balance free speech on the one hand, but you want to make sure that you're taking care of equal protection and protecting people's dignity and so on. So direct and public incitement is prohibited. And I think these media corporations are very much engaged in direct and public incitement to genocide. Advocacy of national, religious, racial hatred and so on. That is prohibited in international human rights law. This is very, very severe form of what you might call hate speech. You have treaties that prohibit propaganda and dissemination of ideas about racial superiority and racial discrimination. So I think when they are doing their calculus, they're not thinking about international law because they're not aware of, or they don't think about the precedents in international law. And they also, I think, are thinking about the fact that in cases since World War II, the only examples of people being prosecuted for these kinds of actions are people in the global south, people in places like Rwanda. And so they think that they are safe. And I think a part of the reason that I wrote this piece was to just get the conversation going on how important it is that there is a sense of responsibility and ultimately a sense of accountability on the part of these companies. Otherwise, they'll continue to do the kind of harmful work that they've been doing for almost a year now, and of course, long before October.
Yeah. How likely is it that you think that one day journalists and Western media platforms might be on a trial for the role in Israel's genocide in Gaza? Do you think this is likely or not?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that smart lawyers and advocates are probably already looking to see which of the most obvious cases might be subject to legal accountability. As I said, this is not editorializing. This is not theory. This is precedent. This is law, and this is precedent. The law exists, and people have been prosecuted successfully. And not just going all the way back to 1945, but most recently in Rwanda. So it's entirely possible. We already know that the International Criminal Court has begun to look at the crimes that are emanating from what's happening in Palestine. We already know that the International Court of Justice is looking, has Israel on trial for genocide. We know that lawyers in national jurisdictions have begun under universal jurisdiction to bring cases as well in places like the US and the UK and elsewhere. So it is not inconceivable that as those processes move forward, you might have some media cases added on as well. That's in international. And by the way, there are some who are talking about the establishment of a dedicated international tribunal to hold Israel accountable for its genocide in Palestine. The resolution adopted today in the General Assembly uses general language about accountability mechanisms, and that there's going to be a study now done by the Secretary General, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, to see what those mechanisms might look like. But you might end up with another international tribunal, like the Rwanda tribunal that held media persons accountable for their contribution to the Rwanda genocide. So it is not at all inconceivable. It's entirely possible. And then even beyond the international level, you could see action in national courts. And as I said, not just criminal action, but in civil courts for damages. And absolutely in the court of public opinion, where you will know from your own work and from talking to people, there is a widespread horror at the way that these media companies have exercised their responsibilities during this genocide.
Yeah. True. And lastly, Craig, what is your message to those Western media outlets and journalists right now, the many journalists right now who still fail to report the full picture and still peddle already the debunked lies in providing cover to Israel to continue its war crimes against the Palestinian people?
Well, I think the message from all of us has to be that they have been exposed, that this is a common topic of conversation amongst people at the absolutely horrendous job that's been done by these media companies in reporting. People are not relying on, many people are not relying upon these companies for information on what's happening in Palestine. It's why they turn to social media. It's why they turn to alternative media. It's why they turn to direct sources. And they can see for the first time in history the direct contrast between what these companies are reporting on the one hand and the reality they're seeing with their own eyes every single day on the other. So these companies are exposed now in a way that they never were in the past. They could get away with this in Vietnam for a certain amount of time. They can't get away with it in Palestine in 2024. So I think accountability is coming, whether it will be accountability in an international tribunal or simply economic accountability, as these companies with declining readership and viewership and subscriptions are already suffering. That trend is going to continue because the message they have sent to the world is that they are unreliable as sources of information and analysis. And I just think they need to be aware that impunity never lasts forever. The moment of accountability will come.
Craig, thank you very, very, very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. So nice to be with you.